Podcast today's show at rte.ie/todaywithseanorourke.
You're welcome back to the programme. Now, before the International Monetary Fund became part of our everyday lives, most Irish people never gave the faceless financial institution a second thought. Sadly, we now know all too much about it. Well, in 2012, Liaquat Ahmed, author and investment manager, went on tour with the IMF to several financially troubled locations, including Dublin. And his book, Money and Tough Love, On Tour with the IMF, documents that trip. Well, Liaquat joins me now on the line from Washington. Thanks very much indeed for joining us this morning. Do you know, it's an absolutely fascinating book because it's true. Most people here know nothing about the origins, the whys, the wheres of the IMF. Before we talk about what you saw in Dublin and what the IMF saw in Dublin, take us back to the beginning of the IMF. Why was it set up? What were the aims?
Well, it was created. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It was created after the Second World War, essentially to avoid a repeat of the Great Depression. In the 1930s, countries had competed against each other and employed a sort of series of beggar thy neighbor policies, which had caused a retreat from globalization. And after the Second World War, two men, John Maynard Keynes of the UK and Harry Dexter White of the US, had this idea that if we could create an international financial institution which would set rules for the way countries behave internationally, that would prevent a repeat of the Great Depression.
And in your book, you say that what has happened with the IMF over the period of its existence is that it hasn't achieved as much as its supporters would have wanted it to, but on the other hand, it's achieved an awful lot more than its detractors said it would. How does it operate now?
Well, when it was first created, it was supposed to regulate international exchange rates. So throughout the 50s and 60s, if a country wanted to change its exchange rate, it had to go to the IMF. That whole system collapsed in the late 60s, and the IMF could very easily have sort of essentially disappeared or become irrelevant. And what really gave it enormous relevance was the debt crisis, the Latin American debt crisis of the late 1970s and early 1980s, because the IMF then stepped in and essentially became a international crisis manager, providing large loans to countries who had got themselves into financial trouble. In return, they would provide these large loans, but would then act as a sort of emergency financial doctor and give countries, they would provide loans on condition that the countries change their economic policies. And that's essentially the IMF that we have today.
Yeah, you describe it as acting almost like an international credit union. People pay in money, but they take out money.
Yeah, and because everyone always asks, where does the IMF get its money from? And this is not aid. This is every country puts in a deposit. And the deposit varies depending on the size of the country and its openness. And this money, which now amounts to about $1 trillion, can be used for those who get into trouble. So typically the countries that borrow, first of all, they vary. So during the 1980s, it was Latin American countries. During the 1990s, it was East European. Then it was Asian countries. And the biggest borrowers today are three European countries, Ireland, Greece, and Portugal.
And now we come to the Irish aspect of the story. I mean, Dublin is quite a large, well, you titled the chapter Dublin, your arrival in Dublin with the IMF, some way into the bailout, if you like. But you say in the book that as far back as 2004, the IMF had begun to sound an alarm over Irish real estate, Irish property prices. They said that the prices were too high, that the banks were lending too much, but that really they didn't understand fully just how big the crisis in our banks was at that point.
Yeah, I think they got they got the story half right. They got the real estate problem right, but they failed to see the leverage of the banks and how unstable the banking system was. So they convinced themselves that, I mean, first of all, no one was listening to them, but they said, look, real estate has gone up too much, and that was sort of obvious to most people from outside, but that, you know, the financial system is in pretty good shape and can cope with the real estate correction. What they failed to recognize was that when real estate started going down, the banks had a gigantic amount of foreign money, and that this money would head for the door.
That was the thing you said, that was, for Ireland, was particularly disastrous. You said it was like dealing with a patient with both kidney failure and heart failure, both at the same time. We had a gaping hole in our budget and a run on its banks when the IMF arrived.
Yeah, and look, the gaping hole in the budget occurred for two reasons. One is the economy completely tanked. I mean, the economy went down about 10%, it's not a Great Depression, but it's half a Great Depression. And that caused tax revenues to fall, also because so much of the tax revenues was coming from real estate, and when real estate sort of just shut down, that caused a budget problem. And then thirdly, the guarantees that the Irish government provided to the banks, the combination of those three things just threw the Irish government's finances completely out of whack. At the same time, you had this essentially this international run on the Irish banking system.
It is interesting. You say that Modi had tried to get Brian Lenihan to take advantage of the IMF's credit facilities in the annual review that the IMF were conducting anyway of Ireland in 2009 and again in 2010. So he knew at that point that Ireland would have needed this credit, but couldn't persuade Irish politicians to take it.
You know, this is one of the problems of borrowing from the IMF, when you go to the IMF, there's a sort of stigma that you've got yourself into trouble. I don't know, it's like, you know, if you had a disease and you went to the doctor and it all appeared in the papers and everyone would look at you differently. So that's always been a challenge for the IMF, which means that countries don't go to the IMF early enough and get money, which would act as sort of a form of inoculating a country against the disease, and always leave it to too late because there's such a stigma attached to borrowing from the IMF.
Yeah, and I suppose you can't really see that changing, can you?
Not really. I mean, they've tried they've got some programs in place where, in effect, you can sign up for a line of credit that you get because the IMF has sort of, if you like, given you a clean bill of health, and almost no one signed up for it.
Mm. The other thing I thought was really interesting was the amount of kind of guesswork, negotiations that went on. I mean, I think that you say in the book, trying to predict how a country is going to cope with the IMF programme involves guessing such things as how far taxes can be raised or welfare benefits cut without triggering, destabilising mass protests. Do you think the IMF were surprised at how far they could go in Ireland without triggering these kind of social protests?
I don't know whether they were surprised, but it's astounding how far they went without triggering social protests. So I think Ireland was was truly a success story for the IMF. I mean, in effect, I'm sure that's why they allowed me to accompany the mission. That there was a bit of self-selection in the process where I went to them and said, well, I'd like to travel around with IMF missions, and they picked countries where they look good. They would not have let me go to Greece, for example.
Yeah. Do you think it might have been better for individuals here in Ireland if we had been a little more vocal about this, if we had taken to the streets, that maybe the tax cuts or the tax hikes and the welfare cuts might have been a little less? Would the IMF have backed down on their demands, or along with the other members of the Troika?
Yeah, the first thing is the IMF was the good cop to the European Central Bank's bad cop. So when they first talked about how much they needed to cut the budget deficit, the Europeans wanted a very big cut. And the IMF said, look, we've got a banking problem, so we've got to go slow on the budget cuts because that will make the banking problem worse. I'm not going to try a medical analogy there because I'll mess it up. But essentially, the IMF was trying to persuaded the European Central Bank to reduce its demands on budgetary austerity. I'm not really an economist, so I'm not in a position to say would it have worked better if the budgetary cuts had been smaller. I was there just to observe, and I was very deliberate that my job on this and what I've tried to do in this book is not pass judgment, but just describe what I saw.
Yeah, and it is absolutely fascinating, starting with the taxi driver who told you that Irish women were to blame because they had pushed their husbands to buy these big houses.
Yeah, well, he was divorced, so he was...
It's an extraordinary analysis of it all. I suppose one of the last lines in your description of the IMF in Dublin is, though the great many teams of economists running around Dublin could congratulate themselves on preventing a terrible collapse, none of them, it seemed, knew quite what it would take to nurse the country back to health. Do you think we're still in that position?
Yes, frankly. Look, Ireland, since I left, has done reasonably well. We're nowhere back to where we were, or Ireland is not back to where it was in 2008. But I say somewhere that the thing about economy, or the thing we understand how to prevent a complete collapse of a financial system as economists, what we don't know how to do is how to restore economies to health. And because, first of all, it seems to vary from country to country.
It's interesting today. I mean, another thing you talk about in the book is the disagreement over the bondholders. You say at one point it would seem there were about 20 billion in outstanding bonds that the Irish government, along with the IMF, felt that it might be possible to let these bondholders be burnt. That you say Ireland did take one for the team there. Is that how the IMF perceive it?
I think so. I think they think the Europeans should have done more to help Ireland, certainly on that bond side, because in a financial crisis you always face a challenge of how to handle foreign bondholders. Because if you start restructuring too early, you actually exacerbate the problem and cause a run. And in Ireland's case, if they had tried to restructure the bondholders in the banks, the Europeans were worried that would provoke a run on other European countries. So the European Central Bank was sort of adamant that Ireland pay off the bondholders, not necessarily because this was good for Ireland, but because this would prevent a run on Portugal and Spain and Cyprus. In the event, it still had a run on those countries.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even today we see news, more people saying that the property bubble, it was Ireland's fault, that, you know, we're not going to get a retrospective help out. Do you think Ireland is due one from the EU?
I think you will get it, but you will get it through the back door, i.e. there's still, and I haven't followed all of the details, but there's There's still a large amount of money that the European Central Bank provides to the Irish Central Bank, that's hidden from view, and in the long run, that will the maturity of that will just be lengthened out, and essentially that's how Ireland will get its help from the Europeans.
Okay, well, Liaquat Ahmed, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. The book is called Money and Tough Love on Tour with the IMF.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.